So I'm looking forward to it.
Great. And I'd like to welcome you to Women Are Not Funny Radio. And I'll just let you draw your own conclusions. You see, my guest today is author and attorney Hannah Hazel Kelchner. She wrote the book, The Business Guide to Legal Literacy, and she calls herself the no-nonsense lawyer. You know me to be the total nonsense lawyer. So what we're going to find out today is whether it's true that she cannot tolerate nonsense. We'll try to put her to that test. So item number one, voiceover intro. Did you hear one? Of course not. But I've heard you, and you've told me you're tired of hearing me talk about it. I know you are, and I don't blame you. I mean, we're well into the second season of Women Are Not Funny, and we still have nothing. But if you recall, I had something written, and it was written by a professional in marketing and communications. And then that comedy coach came along and threw a wrench into things and told me that the voiceover intro had to tell you the reason that you are listening. Now, that was a complete troublesome matter because I don't have the slightest idea why you are listening. And today, I think I've come up with something that's wonderful because it will take you off the hook. So I'm going to go back to the marketing and communications professional who wrote the original script, and I'm going to suggest to him that we come up with a script that will take you off the hook and will just tell the truth, that you are listening accidentally. So, item number two, Ann Curry. One of you sent me a video of Ann Curry testing a new sort of flavored inhaler. It was a segment of the Today Show, and in the caption of your email, you said, Ann Curry gets high, thinking that would amuse me. You see, people try to amuse me, and I like that because I want to be amused. I watched the video, and it's not that I wanted to listen to what she was saying, but the point is I couldn't. I just couldn't do it. And here's the point, and if you recall, the comedy coach says there must be a point. The point is all I could notice is that she desperately needed a good haircut. And Curry needed a haircut in the most obvious way. So essentially what has happened is now the woman has found two ways to be annoying. One is her interview method, which I hate and which I totally follow because I have no choice since I'm annoying in the very same way, like the sound of my own voice better than the sound of the voice of anyone I might interview. But this explains why Ann Curry is such a big star and I am merely an extremely popular, underpaid, in her own mind, fake celebrity. And that is because Ann Curry is willing to take annoying all the way. She's willing to not only annoy her listeners, she's also willing to go on the air with a bad haircut or in need of a haircut, and I am not. I absolutely refuse. So, item three, last week's show. And once again, I have been advised not to talk about last week's show. I have been told with certainty that you do not care about last week's show. If you were here, you already know about last week's show if you weren't here, so what? You don't care. But here's the thing. At Women Are Not Funny Radio, we love our guests, and we do not consider this merely a revolving door where a guest comes on and then they are forgotten. We care. And last week's guest is someone really perfect to care about, Christy Samus. She was delightfully funny, and it's no wonder, as we discovered, she is actually a graduate of Comedy College. But you may also recall that I helped her a lot, and I gave her some really, really good advice. It was kind of part of the Women Are Not Funny Accomplish Something initiative, where we think of stuff, we talk about stuff, and do stuff. And you may recall, or maybe you don't, it just depends, but either way, here's the situation. Christy Samus is a new mother. She has an 8-month-old baby girl, so naturally I gave her some advice about being a mother to this 8-month-old baby girl, and I told her that it is now her duty and her opportunity to throw competitive birthday parties for that little girl every year and to embarrass the other mothers in Napa by the fact that her parties are going to be superior. And she liked that advice, and she understood its value. Then I also helped Christy, who on occasion runs into celebrities. I gave her some ideas about how she could improve her comfort in conversations with celebrities. I told her to start out by telling the celebrity, "Hi there, I'm kind of a big deal," and then, you know, to introduce herself. And she saw the value and the merit of that advice, and I think she's going to be taking it into play and making it part of her mode. And she was very grateful, but I'm also thinking, is that really enough? I mean, we are always looking for additional revenue streams here at Women Are Not Funny Radio. Maybe I should start invoicing my guests for the coaching and advice that I give them. So that's something I'm thinking of, and I'm sure today's guest is excited about that possibility. Well, item number 4. I can only call this "The Pressure Is On." It's probably going to surprise you to learn that someone like me, someone as fabulous as I am, someone who's an actual media mogul, someone without a care in the world, could feel pressure. And I do. And here is what's bothering me today. It's not today's show. No, I can take that in stride. I can do it. I know. I've done it before. But the stakes are a little higher today because next week's guest is a woman, and in total defiance of the premise of this show, she is actually funny. She's written and performed her funny vignettes on NPR. She was a writer and an actual star of Mystery Science Theater. She's Mary Jo Peel, and here's the dilemma. You're probably asking, you know, Kay, are you afraid that she's going to be funnier than you? Oh, goodness, no, I'm not afraid of that. I mean, thank God she'll be funnier than me. Here's the dilemma. She asked me, in preparation for next week's show, which of the episodes she should listen to. Well, I just haven't known how to answer because I already told you I love all my guests, and our shows have been fabulous. And I would say for each of the one-hour shows, we have had at least, if you aggregate all of the funny moments, we've had at least 4 minutes out of the hour that have actually, you know, been somewhat amusing. But which of the episodes should I turn her to? I just simply do not know. So what I think is that today's show could be simply hysterically funny and a perfect representation of how I would want the show to be, then I could direct next week's guest to this show, and she would be impressed, and she would be happy that she had accepted the invitation. So really, you know, that's kind of what's riding on this week's show. Hannah Hassel-Kelchner, can you help me out with that?
I'll do my best. I can't promise because it's a really tall order, Kay.
I know. And, you know, that's the thing that people sometimes forget is women like us who are so terrific, who can accomplish almost anything, still sometimes are up against things that, oh, my goodness. I mean, here I am talking to Hannah, who has been practicing law for almost 30 years. She is a trademark attorney, currently a corporate attorney, and she deals with issues of enforcement for the company she works for. She has written this book called The Business Guide to Legal Literacy, and she went to law school at Rutgers. She got an MBA at Cornell, this Ivy League education. I know the real reason she went there was probably for the ice cream and not for the Ivy League education. But she is definitely a woman of accomplishment, and I'm so happy to have you on the show today.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Are you up? You know, you do call yourself the no-nonsense lawyer.
Yes, I do.
Well, why would you put up with this sort of nonsense?
Well, you know, it's really funny that you mention that because in an ironic way, being authentic and recognizing what's funny when it is all about being real, and it is about no-nonsense. So no-nonsense doesn't mean being dry and boring. It's calling it like it is, and humor lets people see what it's all about sometimes. So it's a very effective device.
Well, I agree with that. But one of the things that I do, and I know you would support this because you definitely believe in being prepared. I mean, that's really kind of the point of your book, is that a person needs to be prepared, particularly if they're in business or and they need to be prepared by knowing something, having a bit of literacy about the law. But one of the things I like to do as a show host, and I kind of got here the hard way, Hannah, is I hate to put you on the spot, but it's just kind of required. I need to know what I'm dealing with. And are you using your appearance on Women Are Not Funny Radio as a stepping stone to something better?
You know, Kay, I would never, ever do that to you. You know, there just isn't enough chocolate, there just isn't enough leopard print heels or enough important gemstones to make me want to do that.
Oh, my goodness. You know, you must be, all I can ascertain from that, Hannah, is that you're really a finer person than many of my guests, because a lot of my guests have admitted that this is merely a stepping stone to something better. But not, I guess you've just tasted such success in your career that, you know, it's hard for you to imagine new heights to climb to. But I still must ask, just in the spirit of being prepared, because I do know that you are very entrepreneurial, and also you have your own series of teleseminars, and you are very, you know, comfortable with a microphone. Is this really kind of an attempt to take over my show? Would you consider this a tryout?
No, I wouldn't do that, Kay. You've got such experience, and you know, you've got this whole persona that I just couldn't begin to scratch the surface of. So I'm in awe of what you're doing here, and I wouldn't dream of ripping the mic out of your hand ever, ever.
Oh, well, that sounds really good. That sounds really good. Well, you wrote The Business Guide to Legal Literacy, and, you know, I'm very impressed by it. In particular, your publisher is Wiley, and I have any number of friends who have written books that have been published by Wiley. But one thing I would say about that publisher is they are not very cuddly. Would you agree with that? you don't want to put down your publisher. I understand. But
well, they're also, it's my first book, so it's not like I have other publishers to compare it to. And I understand that publishing, and I've learned more and more about it in this process, is a really tough business. So I was just thrilled that they were willing to take my manuscript and publish it. And, you know, would you just work with what you have? And they have been supportive as much as any publisher can be, I think, these days. You know, there's so much competition with the e-books now and Kindle readers and everybody else who's coming up with something. So it's not the easiest business to be in, and I have a lot of respect for what they do.
Oh, absolutely. And they are prestigious. Let's face it. I mean, they really are. That's why, you know, it's impressive that they published your book. But I just wondered if you ever considered, and you have a long life ahead of you. There are opportunities that, you know, I'm kind of coming up with. But did you consider going to Harlequin as the publisher, you know, and doing it sort of in the form of a Harlequin romance?
Well, I like to think I have a romance with the law, but I'm not sure that Harlequin would feel that way. You know, I was fortunate to have a literary agent, and so I left it in her competent hands as to find a publisher who would deal with a first-time author. So, you know, sometimes it just unfolds a certain way, but, you know, you never know. There could be sequels.
That's what I was kind of thinking, and you probably should talk to your literary agent. You see, back when I was in college the first time, we were silly. I mean, we were just silly. We thought that if we didn't have a date, if there was ever a night when we didn't have a date, that was humiliating. And so to add to the humiliation, we had this sort of rule that if we didn't have a date, we had to stay there in the dorm, and we had to read this copy that we passed around of a Harlequin romance called Nurse Nancy Goes to Holland. And, you know, I mean, fortunately for me, I always had a date, so I didn't have to read the book. But I happen to know that at this very moment, as we're talking, you are in an automobile, and you are being driven by your chauffeur, also known as your husband. You are being driven to Savannah.
Yes,
and
that's right.
It just crosses my mind. It would be a great book, Attorney Hannah Goes to Savannah.
Oh, now that's got an interesting ring. Yeah, that's good.
It is good. And you can see I'm good at this. I'm really good at this. That would be, don't you think that would be a book that a lot of people would want to read?
Well, you know, the title is certainly catchy. It's got a hook, but how do you think the plot should go?
Well, see, that's up to you, you know. You have the whole weekend ahead of you. I would just kind of live my weekend with the opportunities in mind. Because, you know, we are in a world of opportunity, and that makes me just want us to pause for a moment and consider the wonderment of it all. That I am talking to Attorney Hannah, who is on the road to Savannah. I'm in Texas. We have listeners all over the world. We have an American expat in Thailand who likes to tune in. Our executive producer is in Istanbul. He's tuning in. We have people. In fact, we actually have a lot of men who are listeners. And I think the reason is that they buy into the premise of the show. You know, they think that women are not funny. And it's like every time they tune in, it proves, it bolsters their belief in that.
Now, I'm really surprised, Kay. You let men listen. That's like letting them come behind enemy lines.
But there is something to that. There is something to that. And, you know, that's what I'm very curious about. When I first heard about you and I learned about you because of your book, and I introduced myself as a brother at the bar. Do you recall that?
I do.
How do you feel about that expression? Are we brothers at the bar?
Oh, and any other bar you want to sidle up to. The expressions that we've grown up with, being women of a certain age and, you know, he, she, all this stuff, you know, at the end of the day, we all put our pants on the same way, don't we?
Well, you know, I'm not ready to testify to that, but that is a good point. I will say, though, I mean, you know, one of the things that I learned about you, and I'm always curious about this when I meet other lawyers, is how you happen to end up there, you know, because it's just always fascinating to me. And it's my understanding that your father was involved in that, that he gave you some encouragement.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, with some people wind up going to law school because they couldn't get into med school. that was not the case. I just couldn't think of wearing white all the time. I liked a little diversity, and white always added 10 pounds. But the thing with law school is I guess I was always attracted to the right versus wrong. And my father encouraged me at a very early age. I must have been about 9, 10 years old. And I'm not sure what piqued his curiosity, but it was something that he – you know, he would just kind of gently nudge here and there and guide me. And, of course, back then, I mean, we're talking the dark ages, you know, women became nurses. They became school teachers. Being a lawyer, you know, if I said that, people would look at me cross-eyed. So I finally gave up, and I remember I was in high school one time, and somebody says, oh, so what do you want to do when you grow up? And I'm like, oh, I want to be secretary. And they say, oh, secretary, yeah, that's great. Then I'd say, of state. And we just kind of stop and hold. You know, but, you know, of course, we've had, you know, some brilliant women that are secretaries, have been secretaries of state, starting with Madeleine Albright. So, you know, it doesn't break the ceiling the way it might have so 40 years ago. But anyhow, I never thought twice about it because I also grew up in a very encouraging and nurturing family that basically told me I could do anything I wanted. There were no ceilings. So it was kind of a rude awakening to then come into the real world. So, but I never gave it a second thought. It was going to happen, and it did.
Well, I think that's very, very cool. And you're right, to have your parents and particularly your father encouraging you to go to law school at a time which was really right on the cusp of, you know, it happened very, very quickly, actually. Women didn't go to law school, and then suddenly they did go to law school, and then there were lots of women going to law school. But
right.
I had a very different experience. Also, a father who's very encouraging, but I adore him, but something of a misogynist who probably doesn't believe that women should even be lawyers. But if they have to be lawyers, you know, he just assumed I'd be a lawyer, but... You know, in a perfect world, women would just be breeders, okay? So it's kind of a totally different track there. And the story I tell, Hannah, and the reason I tell it is because, A, it's a true story. B, I like to talk about myself. I spent years saying, I wish I had gone to law school. I should go to law school. I'd like to go to law school. And then, you know, I'm going to law school, which I did, but it never crossed my mind that I wasn't saying I want to be a lawyer. I was saying I want to go to law school, which, you know, arguably I accomplished my dream the day I enrolled. That, you know, that was kind of the end of that. But there are many benefits to being a lawyer. And one of them, you know, I listened to an interview that you did recently, and you talked about the power of intimidation that lawyers have. And what do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think that whole power of intimidation thing is a two-edged sword. While it can be very off-putting, and there may be times that you want to do the power play, by the same token, I think a lot of people are intimidated by lawyers, and as a result, the whole law thing, you know, the law, just is very off-putting. And because they don't understand it, because they don't have the confidence or the training in it, they feel that someone's going to take advantage of them, and that's a fair thing to feel. And that's also the reason why I wrote The Business Guide to Legal Literacy, to kind of demystify it, to put it in plain terms, no-nonsense terms, so that people can say, you know what, this is not that complicated. And more than that, here is why it's important to me and what I do and why I need to get a grip on it. Because if you understand that, then and you know where your rights are, sort of like driving on the road and staying in the lane, there's nothing that can stop you. you'll just keep on rolling instead of being diverted with lawsuits, which are no joke. They're very expensive. They waste time. They divert your attention. And, you know, you've got enough coming at you in business as it is and in your personal life to waste time with that kind of stuff. So it makes a lot of sense from a number of fronts in order to be prepared, to understand, if nothing else, to understand when you need to get more information. You know, I grew up in the Northeast in New Jersey, and when I was growing up, there was this advertisement I will never forget. It was for a clothier called Size Sims. I'm not sure they're still in business, but their advertisement slogan was, an educated consumer is our best customer, because what their focus on was value. They were not the most expensive store in the world, but they offered value. They offered service. And I've always remembered that, because when it comes to the law, someone who understands what value is never going to get shortchanged. So I think there's a lot to be said for that.
Wow. You know, you are no nonsense. And
well, why waste time?
Well, no, here's the thing. There is really very little for me that is more enjoyable than to listen to someone's voice completely change when they talk about something they're passionate about. And that doesn't matter whether it is, you know, a new kitten or a point of view about the law and about how people should operate within the world in terms of their understanding of it. But so it kind of pains me a little bit, given that you have these very heartfelt and closely felt and very admirable beliefs and things you're trying to accomplish in this vein. But I hope you can understand a little bit and be a little, have a little bit of empathy for someone like me who, you know, kind of likes that whole intimidation thing, because it is, you know, it's one thing I have going for me. I may be the accidental lawyer, as I like to say, but, you know, at least when people find out I'm a lawyer, they're a little bit intimidated. I would hate for them to all buy your book and all read your book and all, you know, become literally legally literate, and I would no longer have that ability to intimidate people. I mean, isn't that one of the benefits of going to law school?
Well, it could be, but, you know, it can also be awkward at times. I remember being in a social setting once, and I've just met somebody, and we're chatting, and, you know, the usual little small talk, and someone joins us and says, oh, by the way, do you know that Hannah was a lawyer? You should have seen the look on their face. They just turned sheet white. And you'd think they had just been read Miranda rights.
Yeah.
You know?
Guess what? I have seen that look. I've seen that look.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's,
you know
what I'm
what
talking
I mean.
About. That's what I'm saying. It's kind of like, yeah, I do. I love it. And but see, this is one of the things that would be awful, is to go to law school and find out, you know, you go there because you want to be able to intimidate other people by letting them know you're a lawyer. And then you find out it's no longer intimidating. And, you know, there are in this country, I think, and they're doing, well, I actually just filled out the census. It doesn't really ask about occupation. But, you know, I think, statistically, I think there are now 4 billion lawyers living in the United States, and so there are a few, but it still has that ability to intimidate. One thing that was kind of weird for me is when I got to law school is to be told by the legal writing instructors that we were going to try to make our legal writing, you know, easy for people to understand and eliminate legalese. And then, you know, and that was devastating to me as well, because I thought, you know, here I am. I want a professional education in how to really confuse people by using legal terms they do not understand. And you're telling me that that has gone out of style. I mean, how do you feel about that?
Well, you know, it sounds a little bit like the way I felt when I discovered that the courts were no longer requiring pleadings to be submitted on legal-sized paper. I thought that was part of the benefit of going to law school, to have the right to use legal-sized paper instead of letter size, you know.
You know exactly what I'm talking about. There's some of those little perks that should exist. Now, one that still does exist, even though, yes, legal size paper is totally out of vogue, and we're supposed to be able to write legal documents that people can actually read. You know, very few follow that rule. But we get to hang out with other lawyers. I mean, you mentioned Madeleine Albright. We hang out with her and Gloria Allred and, you know, other celebrity lawyers like you and me. We celebrity lawyers kind of stick together, don't you find? We're
yeah,
kind of drawn
you know,
to each other.
I think so. I think there's a certain kindred spirit there. And the thing is, though, I think you'll admit, too, that there's a time you want to use that intimidation factor and a time that you don't. You know, use it like a rifle shot when it's appropriate, because otherwise you're not going to be able to help people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is true, but I, you know, you don't know me well yet, but as you get to know me, you will understand that I am not about appropriate. I'm just really not. But when one of the things, and here's proof of it. I'm about to name drop in kind of a big way, and I in kind of a smart alecky way, because I think it's the story. Little story I'm going to tell is a little unusual. For a period of time, I was working in downtown Washington, D.C., and I lived in Virginia in the mountains and still have my home there. And I bought a little apartment on the waterfront in downtown D.C., and there was a neighborhood Safeway store where I would do my shopping when I was there. And someone else who lived in my apartment complex was former Supreme Court Justice David Souter. Okay, and so I would occasionally see him in the grocery store, and he would look exactly like himself. Did you know that? I mean, he actually looked exactly like himself.
So you recognized him instantly, yeah.
You recognized him instantly. And so then you could go, what it meant was you could go there and you knew a good bit if you read the paper and you followed the court. You knew about his judicial decisions. But if you went to that Safeway store and you happened to be there at just the right time, you could witness how he made decisions about which Little Debbie product he wanted to buy.
Really?
And yeah. And strangely enough, I mean, people were not. Would you call him a famous lawyer?
Within certain circles, you know, I don't think he's a household name, but I think that certainly those folks that follow the Supreme Court, they certainly know him.
They would know him. Well, the reason I asked you is that he was able to do his grocery shopping without being mobbed. You know, it wasn't. There were no paparazzi. People weren't all over him like Johnny Depp, like they would be. Like I think if Johnny Depp were at the Safeway store picking out his Little Debbies, I think people would notice. Don't you? I mean, I'm just.
No, I think you're absolutely right. But you know, the Supreme Court justices are typically not treated like rock stars. They are more low key. You know, it's just that seriousness of the law.
Mm-hmm. I guess my point is, you know, You and I are celebrity lawyers, obviously, and there just seem to be limits, unfortunately, to how far that will take you.
Do you get mobbed at the grocery store?
No, that's my point. I don't. You know, I don't.
Terrible.
But anyway, one of the things, you know, I mentioned the fact that we're brothers at the bar, and that's a well-worn expression, even though, and I was actually in law school, I was a member of a fraternity, you know,
and
a legal fraternity. Yeah, I was. But one of the things that I did while I was in law school was purposely hang out with the guys. And I think my reason for doing, I had several reasons for doing that. One is I like guys. Two, I thought, you know, this, and at the time I went to law school, it was more so than it is now, but this is truly a male profession, and my ability to succeed in it is going to relate directly to my ability to interact with men in, you know, in this professional setting. So most of my friends were men, and I just wondered if you shared that experience or how you felt about that.
Well, I think that was a smart move on your part. I wish I had been that smart. I had one law professor tell me that my problem is I treat people as equals.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know.
Yeah, I'm never guilty of anything admirable. But the thing that I noticed is in some of your writing and your speaking, you've used male analogies. I mean, you use a lot of analogies that are that I would call male analogies.
I'm glad you said analogy because, you know, this connection's a little hard to hear, and I thought you said anatomy for a second.
No. I've seen your photo, and there's, you know, you're all female. You're quite lovely, but you use these sports analogies. You know, you talk about a playing field and smoking guns and landmines and pull the trigger. And I just noticed you're co-opting male analogies.
Well, I don't know. I think women can pull the trigger. I think women are known to have smoking guns. I mean, you know, let's be fair here, okay? I'm not sure that's so male-oriented. Now, if I get into a football playing field, yeah, that's fair. But,
playing
you know,
field.
Women have come a long way in sports.
What about foul lines? Foul lines.
Yeah, you'd think they'd understand that. You know, I try to make it simple for them. That's why I do that, you know.
I
don't
see.
Know if I'm succeeding. I don't know.
I see. Well, your book is full of practical information, and one of the things that I know in just a conversation that I had with you earlier in the week, that you are a big advocate of a tool that we all have within our toolbox. How's that? It's a tool within our toolbox. Would you consider that a male analogy? I'm using it. It's my male analogy. Are you? How are you relating to it? A tool. I'm about to tell you what I'm talking about. You know, because
okay.
my comedy coach, which by the way, you would never know this. My comedy coach told me I was hopeless, that I was remarkably unfunny, but he did give me a few tips, and one of them was to always have a point in what I was saying, and to get to the point. And so I work on that, but I surely haven't gotten there. But anyway, toolkit, this tool, a tool that I want to. You obviously do not want to answer my question. That's fine. But the underlying question is the tool in everyone's toolkit that you advocate is being ready with an apology.
Oh, I think that can be very valuable. That, I mean, provided it's a sincere apology, I think that can go a long way to keeping things from escalating and turning ugly. You know, it has to be done in the right place in the right time, you know. And you had mentioned my interview series. You know, one of the folks that I had interviewed about a year ago was a fellow by the name of John Cater, because he had a new book out called Effective Apology. And he just lays it out in really beautiful terms about what makes one apology effective over another. And then when you read the newspapers these days, you know, you see them all over the place, you know, like the Pope's ineffective apology last week. People are hammering that one right now. So, yeah, it can be a very, very powerful tool. And there have been some really sad stories when people haven't apologized at the right place in the right time.
Is it your experience with your clients, and you may have noticed I am totally focused on gender differences. I, you know, goodness knows why, but has it been your experience that women are more capable of apologizing, more ready to apologize than your men clients? Have you noticed any trend in that?
Well, some folks might say that women apologize too easily and too readily, and that it might actually detract from their
mm-hmm.
effectiveness, because you have some people who never apologize anyway, no how, no matter how wrong they are. It's like it's ingrained in them. And I don't like to see it so much as a gender issue as much as a leadership issue, and one that cuts across gender lines. And I wish more men were capable of it, because it would certainly stop a lot of nonsense that happens in offices. And many of your listeners could probably relate to that. You know, if the right person could step in and say, you know, cut the nonsense, this is what we're going to do, and do it in a way that is actually listening to people and the right apologies happening at the right place and the right time. You know, people know you, things happen, and you spend a lot of time in the office with folks that, more time probably than your family. And so there will be frictions. People have differences of opinion, and it's about how you resolve those conflicts. And apology is one way not to let things fester and to move on and to say, okay, I value the relationship more than I value being right on this particular point. So let's move on. And that's a leadership skill, and it requires strength. And people don't appreciate that. They're really losing out on a very, very valuable tool, an effective tool.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. Although I don't know that an apology that is immediately followed by the words "let's move on" is is one that I love. But you do talk about the effect of saying the wrong words at the wrong time, and I'm aware that you have a story about a woman who got a bad permanent. And then she heard the wrong words at the wrong time.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. I mean, and that would have been a perfect example of apology, you know, allowing things to get smoothed over and the relationship to continue. And the hairdresser story involved a woman who was getting a permanent wave. And picture her as your mother's age, you know, she with the little tight curls and all that kind of stuff. So she was getting her permanent wave, and she was about to put her head back in the sink and have the neutralizing solution put on, and all of a sudden there was this clatter, and what happened is the curlers fell out of her hair with the hair still attached. And so she was partially bald, and she was just horrified. You know, I mean, she was
Anyone would be.
Yeah, exactly. And the first thing she said, first words out of her mouth is, how am I going to face my husband? You know, she was just so embarrassed by her appearance, and it was a pretty big salon. The hairdresser was quick on her feet. She says, look, you know, there's some wigs over here on the other side. I'll go find one. I know we have something that's close to your hair color. We'll match it. I'll style it. And, you know, I'm not going to say he won't notice the difference, but it's not, you know, you can look at yourself in the mirror. It's not going to be so bad. And that's exactly what she did. You know, snip, snip, and boom, it was done. And, she, you know, the woman calmed down. You could see she was just visibly more relaxed. She knew her hair would grow out again. It would be fine. But as she's gathering her purse and, you know, the tape is coming off, the hairdresser turns to her and says, you know, you don't have to tip me today. And her jaw just dropped. She just couldn't believe what she was hearing. And she was angry. And she was steaming for several days and then marched into her lawyer's office and filed a suit. Against the hairdresser, against the salon, against the manufacturer of the permanent solution. And she won. She won monetary recovery from all three. Now, you know, you mentioned apology. Suppose the hairdresser has said, I am so sorry this happened. You know, this is no charge today, and I would really like you to come on into the salon and have a spa treatment on me or a manicure or whatever. You know, offer her some kind of compensation for her inconvenience and embarrassment and humiliation, that person would have been a fan for life. She would have helped strengthen that relationship instead of destroying it. And you just know that that woman went home, got on the phone to all her friends, you'll never believe what happened to me, And there it goes. It could have so easily changed. If only the hairdresser realized, oh, my gosh, I could have a big liability exposure, just a little bit of legal literacy on her part to realize I need to find a way to smooth this over. Because, Kay, I'm sure, you know, you having practiced yourself, there are two things that will motivate somebody to file a lawsuit. One is having a good case. And the other is having the incentive to do so. So even though the facts may be in their favor, they won't necessarily file if it's like, well, you know, I like Kay. I'm going to do more business with Kay. We got a relationship. I've been coming here. I've been working with her for years now, and I want to keep doing that. So why would I mess it up with a lawsuit as opposed to somebody who says, she did what? And then, you know, boom, they pulled the trigger.
Well, it is true that most people will forgive if the apology is stated right, or as you say, if there's a pre-existing relationship that would cause them to maybe not be overcome by a setback or a temporary setback, although you will agree that people do expect from their lawyers, they do expect competence, right? I mean,
they truly did. Right.
And I was very well-loved by my clients, but part of the reason I was well-loved, as you know and as you experience every day, is because of competence. You know, that's what makes a lawyer lovable, in addition to, in my case, being adorable and modest. But there is something else that hairdressers need to know, and that is we also expect competence from our hairdressers, do we not?
Oh, of course. Of course.
I mean, we really do. We really do, because it's kind of where the rubber hits the road. You know, you want all your legal documents to be in great shape, but you want your hair to look beautiful. Can you deny that? It has to.
No, it has to. Plus, you're letting somebody close to your head with a scissor, a sharp object. You know, you've got to trust them.
Absolutely. And when they violate that trust, you know, it would take a gigantic apology, in my opinion. You know, let me just tell you what happened to me, Hannah. Okay, so I am in Texas, which is my winter home, and I have never here found quite the right hairdresser. I did find someone who I thought was terrific. She immediately moved to Florida without it, you know, she didn't consult me. She didn't, it was just one of those things that happened very suddenly, and I didn't care for it at all. But I found another hairdresser, and I thought she was okay, and maybe a little better than okay. So we were on our second appointment, and she did my hair. And I looked at it, and I just looked darn good. You know, I looked really good. And unsurprisingly, you know, and this is how I wanted to look. And then she handed me a mirror to look at the back of my hair. And so she twirled me around, and I looked at the back of my hair, and I said, oh, no. Oh, you know, no way. No, you're going to have to fix that. And she said, oh, well, I just don't know if I can't. What, you know, she was really kind of perplexed. I said, well, it just won't do at all. It's just wrong. You know, the back of my hair cannot look that way. You're going to have to fix it. And she said, well, I just don't think there's anything I can do. And I said, well, I can't stand it. I hate it. You have to fix it. She said, well, I think we're just going to have to let it grow, and we'll just cut it in a different way next time. And I said, well, I am not the least bit happy. In fact, I am decidedly unhappy. And do you know what she said to me, Hannah?
No,
she
said, I can't imagine what.
She said, let me give you a hug.
Oh, boy.
Mm-hmm.
Wrong answer.
Wrong answer. She said, let me give you a hug. I said, I do not want a hug. I want the back of my hair not to look this way. So, you know, she may have thought she was giving me an apology, you know. No, let me give you a hug. That, you know, if I know you don't really, you know, accept in your writing and that sort of thing, advise people in the salon business, but if you ever have the occasion to, tell them that that is not a good, you know, that doesn't mitigate things. Hugs do not mitigate bad haircuts. Do you recommend hugs generally as mitigation for bad behavior?
Oh, heavens, no. No. That could open the door to harassment claims. You never know where that goes. No. Hands off. Uh-uh.
Yeah.
Not in business.
Yeah. Well, I did, you know, obviously I didn't think it was a good idea, but, you know, I thought it probably had broader applications, but I just knew for me that was not working.
No, I don't blame you. Not at all. I would have said the same thing.
So your husband, who is also a chauffeur, apparently, does he object to you being a lawyer?
No, not at all. Actually, he brags about it.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Did you have to train him to do that, or did he come by that?
No. He's one of my friends and cheerleaders, and I waited a long time to find him. So no.
Oh.
He's wonderful.
Well, that is absolutely fabulous. You know, does he also support your entrepreneurial tendencies?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. You know, he's got his own Facebook page, and whenever something good happens, he broadcasts it to all his friends. You know, go take a look at this link. Go look at that. So, no, he's really one in a million. And no, you can't have him.
Well, we'll see. The thing about it, you know, the story is yet unwritten, Hannah. So one of the things that I love about your point of view is that not only are you an entrepreneur, but you are someone who really understands the difference between risk management and risk avoidance, and state very, very succinctly that you are not against risk, you just want people to understand it.
Right, to be smart about it, because, you know, everything is a risk, and it's kind of silly to say, well, you have to bring risk to zero. I just want people to understand where it could be so that they can manage it and not be surprised, because there's nothing worse than putting your head in the sand and making your butt a bigger target than to be surprised when somebody hits it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as someone my entire life who has been told, you know, starting from the time I was a tiny little girl, be careful, be careful, be careful. Do you think, you know, what do you think about that as advice?
Well, I think it's important to be careful and, you know, to develop that peripheral vision, if you will, but you can't be paralyzed by it. So get the information, make smart decisions, and move forward. I think that's good advice in any kind of arena, business or personal life. But get the information. I think the worst thing that can happen is when people are in denial about something and or assume things away, and then they get surprised. You know, and in a perverse way, that's how new laws get created. You know, people go to extremes and somebody says, wait a minute, that's not right. Guess what? There's no law. It's not illegal, but it soon will be, and that's why we have all these new regulations that are coming at us.
Well, I take great interest in your work in the intellectual property arena, and particularly with trademark, and I assume you're doing trademark enforcement in your current work, but I had a situation fairly recently. I bought a domain name, and the reason I bought it is I have on occasion given a talk with this name. And so I bought the PradaBagLady.com or PradaBagLady.com. Now, I love Prada, truly do. And I was very sad to get an email from one of their lawyers in Italy saying, hey, no, you cannot do that. You cannot use it. You cannot. We will go after you. We will, you know, the end. And because for me, it was the end. You know, and without going into the you know, possibilities in terms of defending that possibility, I just said, I won't play. But what do you think about that? The Prada Bag Lady is dead for Kay Ballard.
Wow, I can see your disappointment. on the other hand, I can see the other side as well. You know, it's like there's this big suit going on right now between the makers of North Face and someone who tried to play off of that and a line of clothing called South Butt. Very similar logo as well, just sort of reversing it, you know, to mimic the contours of the South Butt, and a similar type of argument being made, but somebody didn't quite have the wisdom that you did in determining when you hold them and when you fold them. So that one's being played out, and with a lot of drama, I might add. It makes for some interesting reading if you Google that.
Yeah, that sounds like an interesting case. And I think, case Prada against Kay Ballard could be interesting too, but if I have money that is devoted to Prada, it probably should go to, I don't know, shoes and maybe sweaters. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. I mean, if you're going to spend the money on it, do it where you can get some actual benefit. But recognizing that, you know, is where the legal literacy comes in. And so all of those are good things.
Well, yeah, and I mean, it begs the question. I guess there are two ways to become legally literate. One would be to actually go to law school, and the other would be to buy your book, right? I mean, it's one or the other,
oh, yeah.
Probably.
And it's much cheaper than a lawsuit, so, you know, it's a deal.
Well, that is true, although you would agree lawsuits can be, in their own way, entertaining.
They can, you know, but it's like watching a pratfall. It's more fun from the outside than the one who's actually going down and getting hurt. In the middle of it, it's, you know, it's the drama. But if you're standing on the outside with popcorn, it's great theater, which is, you know, where I got so much material for my book, you know, the smoking gun example. You know, how could people say this? How could they write this? But they do, and they don't recognize that. Guess what? Now you get to explain it to a jury of your peers, and it's blown up, you know, billboard size for everybody to see. With highlighting and, oh, that's not what you meant? Well, let them decide what you meant, because it's not your document anymore. It's evidence. Lawsuits are just not fun.
That's one of the interesting things that you have pointed out, and you are among the number of lawyers who are active in social media. It's, you know, it's kind of interesting to me to look and see how many are involved and how many know about social media, either as participants or just being aware of it. And my own read on that, Hannah, is that not enough do, not enough understand that there are huge implications for their clients. Because of our ability to communicate in these new methods and the documentation that is built into them, and as you say, they become evidence.
Oh, yeah. It's fascinating, really. You know, and I noticed that one of the things you did on your website is to link my name to my Twitter account, and I have to admit, Kay, is that you're going to push me off the Twitter branch because I set this up. But I really haven't done any tweeting, so it's like, okay, I really have to, you know, get serious about this, which I've wanted to do, is why I set up the account. But there's just so much to learn, and I think that just being open to those possibilities and opportunities is one way that we grow as individuals. So it's going to be a new world for me.
Yeah, well, it is a Twitter is a new world, and I welcome you there. I hope you love it like I do. But there are so many different platforms, and I'm someone who is the proud owner of a deactivated Facebook account. So every social media platform is not for everyone, but I certainly have found Twitter as a real good source for meeting some very high-achieving people and some who've turned into friends. So that's been a wonderful thing. But, you know, you have on your website, you have a list of rules for people to take a look at, and they're I think it's fair to call them a list of rules. I can't remember exactly what you call them, but you write right up at the front, one is about confidentiality and keeping things confidential. And I read that and, you know, just kind of bristled because I'm someone who likes to talk.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with talking. I think that's wonderful. It's the way we meet people, create new relationships, and open the door to opportunities. I think it's just a matter of being careful what we talk about. And I think particularly young people today who have come of age with the new media, which, you know, to me is fairly new, they take it all in as second nature and are putting things out there that maybe 20 years from now they would regret, because I can tell you that I would have said things in my 20s I wouldn't dream of saying today, and vice versa. But they have
that's kind of my method for staying young. Some of the others don't work, but, you know, just being as outrageously open as a teenager, you know, don't you think that might be a youth achieving method?
Well, yeah, I think it could help, definitely, and we should all be young for a certain period of time and stay young in our hearts, for sure. But in order not to get derailed from the adult things that we want to achieve, we need to be exercising judgment. And that certainly comes, the wisdom comes with age and having made a ton of mistakes. And when those mistakes get memorialized on the Internet and archived on the Internet and have this sort of radioactive shelf life on the Internet, it's like you can never put it behind you, you know. I mean, years ago you could leave home, go to college in another state, and leave your high school friends behind. Now they all stay connected, which could be a good thing, but it's like, you know, if you've gone from elementary school through grade 12 with these people, you know, you might want to be a different person by the time you get to college than you were in, say, seventh grade and have people remember, you know, when somebody bullied you on the playground. We should have a right to sort of outgrow our childhood peccadilloes, if you will. And that may not be possible if everybody is broadcasting and having their underwear hang out on the Internet.
Well, I think you're right. I don't know what to do about it. But we'll solve that problem on another day because our time is up. I know you're almost in Savannah. I hope you have a wonderful, wonderful weekend this weekend. And thank you for being here. I want all of our listeners to know that they can find out more about you by clicking on the links on our website in the show notes. Hannah, I have, on the last two shows, I have cut off my guest mid-sentence with my William Tell Overture tricycle. So I am determined not to do that to you. Thank you so much for being here today and for taking the time to talk with us while you're barreling down the road to your fun weekend.
My pleasure. Thank you.